One thing that I've learned is no matter the size of the brand, you know, just bring it back to the basics. Yeah, it's not because you're coming in with the logo of the Canadians or not better than someone. So I always trusted the salespeople I was talking to, the media people I was talking to, and they're the best at what they do. So, you know, I was a representative of a great brand, but if I listened to them, they'd make me look smart.
Welcome to the Leaders of Tomorrow podcast. My name is Chris Thompson, your host of the show and the head coach of the Student Works Management Program. This is a show dedicated to young and ambitious entrepreneurs and ultimately the leaders of tomorrow. Each week, we will bring you an inspiring interview or message to help you create the future you know you deserve. Let's get started.
Hey, leaders. I have an amazing young leader who has had a really, really amazing career. Obviously, one of our top operators. He moved on to Ricoh, you know, sort of Ricoh, Canon, Xerox, a bunch of the people who train to sell photocopiers. There still is that space, but I think more and more, you know, software as a service businesses are where our operators are going, because that business is shifting with all the technology changes. He moved into interactive marketing company, and which eventually put him into the Montreal Canadiens, and spent about 7 years with the Montreal Canadiens and developed into a senior manager of media planning and innovation. And the last three and a half years, he is head of procurement of Energyplast and Les Plastiques. A really, really large organization with multiple facilities in Ontario and in Quebec in plastics recycling. So we just had a fantastic conversation about the things that John's learned and about really becoming a leader and a value creator in our economy. So, you know, why we do these podcasts is really to attract amazing young people like John. To come and get involved in our program to learn to become the leaders of tomorrow. So if you know any amazing leaders, please send me an email at cthompson@studentworks.com. You could share this podcast with them, or you could send them to studentworks.com. We start our recruiting in the summer 2024 for 2025. Last year, we were basically filled mostly all of our spots. So it's really difficult to get involved. So if you know anyone, they'll need to apply quickly. Thanks so much, and have yourself a super fantastic day. Welcome, John, and welcome to the Leaders of Tomorrow podcast.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Hey, so excited to have you. And I know it's been quite a while. It's amazing how fast time flies. But you know, it does. You know, I just can remember you back in the program. You know, and I know it wasn't like yesterday. As we'll find out, but you know, the summer of, I guess, 2008. But you know, talk about before you were an operator. Who was John?
Yeah. Well, I think I was the type of guy. My dad was a salesman, so I you know, learned and followed him around. So sales was always kind of part of my genes. I loved to be out there. I was very outgoing. Got into sports, was never particularly incredible at any of them, but you know, just wanted to stay active. Highly involved on that side. And I think you know, was going through school was a bit of a challenge. Sports kind of kept me attached to it until met you guys at Student Works and found another passion there to keep me going in university and have something else to do at the same time.
Yeah, making it a lot more real, right? Like for me, I found the same thing. All of a sudden, it's, oh wow, you know, this is real life. This is I'm you know, and all of a sudden, school makes a lot more sense. I think a lot of our operators feel the same.
I'd say even the, you know, the entrepreneurship class, which, you know, it's very book theory and all that, but it was funny having conversations with the professor and saying, you sure that works? I tried it this summer with a bunch of college students, and I don't think that did work. So that was an interesting aspect to it, but also the side of having to manage our time, because running a business already is something, and then you've got your course load. It made you, I don't know, I think it made me focus on school when I had time for school, And then I'd go out and do our cold calls and, you know, start the year and all that. So it was, you know, with hindsight during it, it looks like a lot, but, you know, with hindsight, best duo there was to do.
Yeah. And so thinking back, what do you still use from your time at StudentWorks?
A big part of it, I think the time management part, for sure, you know, organizing business life and then the rest around it. There's a lot of the sales side to it. I mean, there's something about going and knocking on doors in the city of people you don't always know and just say, hey, I'm here to paint your house, which, you know, for a lot of people, I know now with my own home and you want to take care of it. You want to have the right people doing it. So got this, you know, youngster coming in saying, I'll do it. I'll be the best doing it. So, you know, kind of trying that out and noticing that if I could sell that, and, you know, I was a rookie painter at that time and it worked out really well. So it kind of got me going. So that's one part that I use a lot of now, time management, the whole lead generation and going out there, working hard to get leads to come in. That's how you get your business running. And yeah, that's how you get all the rewards for it, the more leads you bring in. So that, I think those are the habits that I built back then that I just kept going in whatever business I was in. There's a couple of businesses that were very sales focused. It's all about how many calls you make and how many people you bring in and how many contracts you sign.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and we'll actually start to do that. But that premise and most successful people understand that, right? Like, and they depersonalize it. It's like, okay, someone doesn't want to buy my photocopier, someone doesn't want to buy my painting services, no concern. You know, maybe next time, and have a wonderful day. And hey, maybe next time they're interested. And it's just understanding that it's just part of the process. And that's what successful people do, you know, you know, it's kind of just having the ability to have conversations with people, getting over that fear and that anxiety is such an incredible skill set, because in my mind, again, you can't be a really great leader if I've got that fear, or if I do have the fear, I'm just doing it anyway. But I think most people give it up.
I was going to say it's fun. It was fun back then too, because in my case, it was a pretty successful year. Is that every week you'd start seeing the numbers come in, and every week we'd sit down with my manager Heidi at the time and look at this week. And, you know, at first you're alone in your little corner, but then they compare it to other people in the program, and then hey, you're part of the top two this week. You know, you start getting hooked to it too. Then there's that side, you know, you get proud and you see the real results. And, you know, I guess doing it with StudentWorks too is that there's, you know, so not just selling it, it's selling at the right price, because you don't want to, you know, you don't want to do just sell a painting project, but you want to make money
sell
off
it, of it. Make money.
You bet. Exactly. So that's the other part of the learning process that was there. And it's fun doing it at that age, because then you know, you come into the workforce later on and you've already lived it. So, you know, you're not as affected for, you know, so I think even great salespeople hear no 70% of the time. So you have to get used to that. But if you know, start off quick, it's easier to start your career after that.
For sure. And so you moved after StudentWorks and after Concordia, you moved to Rico and another sales role. So what did you experience there? What did you learn there? What was different, et cetera? What was similar?
I think there's one thing, and I know Harry Gerberg, which is the other student painter that was in my year. I think he went over to Xerox. So they're great companies in terms of training. You get into a big machine. I think the fun part of me getting into Rico at that time is that they were large, and I got into direct accounts right away. I didn't go through the dealership side, where usually that's where you'll start and you'll start selling, you know, smaller printers and ink and all that. I got right in and I had major accounts right away. So it was it was quite the process. They send you in for 2-week training in Toronto, and they make you a great salesperson, because that's a very, you know, highly competitive area. There's so many printer companies out there, and the IT guy that you're calling, he doesn't really want to talk to you, you know? So it starts off like that, right? And then you have to find your way in and find new ways, and you get your postal codes and which businesses are there. I think I took that challenge on, right away, just because I had Arlene Addis was my manager at the time, and I think it was their Icon that it was called, and they got bought up by Rico, and that's where the opportunity came about. And she kind of trusted me on the fact that I did StudentWorks. I mean, we met at a at a show at Concordia for a job fair. And I was helping her break down her booth at the end of it. And she says, hey, what have you done? And kind of talk about her, my CV. And what stood out at that time was the Student Works program. So she had saw that I had, made the President's Club, and that started. She says, you know what, let's give you a try. So I knew that she had that confidence in me, and that kind of gave me a boost. Great program, great learning experience. Selling printers is one thing. I think, in my mind, I'm more of a, you'll see later, I'm more of a sports guy. So, it was a great experience, and I really, really happy I did it too. Money wise too. I mean, the sky's the limit, the more you sell, the more you can make, and there's no limit of being a junior coordinator or anything. If you go out there and land some big accounts, you'll get rewarded for it too. So that's another part that's very interesting. After going through Student Works, it was kind of a nice flow to it, to continue, managing my own income based on my performance.
By your performance. Exactly. And so you stayed there, got great training, got into a great role because of the Student Works experience. What was next?
Yeah. So after that, I think one thing that was important right when I got into university, even college, when I went to Dawson, left Council and went to Dawson, I started noticing that I probably wouldn't be playing in sports because I wasn't that great, but I wanted to potentially work in sports. So I was trying to find ways to get closer and closer to Montreal sports teams. So Rico, while I was at Rico became sponsor of the Montreal Canadiens, kind of saw that potential in the future. And I figured at that point, since stuff was going well at Rico, I'd won some salesman of the month, and I'd won some presentation competitions and all that. An opportunity came about for a friend of mine. His they had a sports company called Tupi Casino Spa, which is now called Sportle, and they made software for minor hockey organizations and federations. And that was super tied into Montreal sports, because what a lot of sports teams want to reach at is grassroots sports fans and their parents and those families, and get them into the arena. So switched over to Pipi Casino Spa, and it was completely different experience, a smaller startup. But what I found that was great is that I already had the background of knowing what it is to have your own business. So there was a respect there that I had for the owners that were very young. Just kind of joined the team and be an integral part of that, and went on to sign some major sports teams too, and start playing in that league and trying to see these teams get into the offices and see how they run, and kind of foresee myself maybe getting that job one day. So Sportle was a great great second experience. Smaller in terms of size of a company, but great, great growth potential. And it got me on the advertising side too. So I'm a bit of a nerd at heart. I've always been fiddling in computers and all that. So getting into advertising and online advertising and all that built that knowledge while I was there at the Pipi Casino Spa.
Right, right. And that's actually a great thing for leaders is to really, again, go scratch that itch. What interests you? What are you passionate about? Right? Like, go in that direction. What are you reading at night? Okay, well then let's see if I can get paid to that, to do that. Cause, and so that's obviously for you, marketing and advertising was a real passion.
And one thing that had come out too, and this goes back in university, so just after my first year of the Student Works program, I had a sports marketing class that you had to be selected for. And within that class, Ray Lalonde came by. Ray Lalonde was the vice president of marketing for the Montreal Canadiens. And he came to class, did a full presentation. And after a presentation, I think what happens often is, every student will go up and kind of talk to the presenter and kind of ask them for a job and give them their CV and all that. And they're kind of there just, shaking with their CV and just dropping off and kind of running away after. And what I did at that time, as I went up to him and I asked him, I said, hey, listen, I know my CV is not ready. I'm not ready to be a Montreal Canadiens employee. Not enough experience yet, but I kind of wanted you to look at this and tell me, what am I missing? So the fun part is he skimmed through my CV and, noticed everything I'd been doing, extracurricular student works and all that. And he says, you need to get some C-level executive experience. So I walked out of the class, took out my BlackBerry and Googled what a C-level executive was. So, and funny enough, what did pop up was a lot of these sales jobs. That's, you know, you will sell to C-level executives. So that, you know, the VP of IT is a C-level executive. So that might have pushed me also. You know, this is all with hindsight at the moment, you know, probably just past my mind, but now I see it where there's a connection between all of us. I was getting closer and closer and trying to showcasing that, hey, I've done it all. I've sold to C-level executives, some huge businesses while I was at Ricoh, went on to do more federation, professional sports when I was at the PPK Saint Spa. Sportal. And so, yes, I think that, you know, that got me ready for the next opportunity.
Yeah. And so obviously that's the Montreal Canadiens. So how did that opportunity come up?
Yeah. It was a fun one. It was one of those moments too, where I get attached to the jobs I do. I get really passionate. I become a bit of a brand ambassador for a lot of the businesses I'm in. So leaving a place is not always easy. But one evening I got a phone call from, so I was essentially selling advertising programs, to Kim Marois, which was the media buyer, for the Montreal Canadiens. And, she was about to leave on a maternity leave and they hadn't found a replacement yet. So she kind of gave me a call and says, would you be interested? I just want to give your name, but I want to know, you know, are you ready to take the step? And, you know, So yeah, evidently that hit me. Took the opportunity and got to meet John Trzynski and Dino Di Pancreas, are the two directors of marketing at the Habs, and they essentially offered me a 15-month position. So it was a maternity leave replacement, but there was, I mean, you know, you give me a chance like that, and I'll take it. So it was 15 months for me to prove that, hey, I'm made to be here. That was incredible experience. I got the phone call one evening that John, you know, congrats, we selected you. We'd like you to start the game nights in 2 days, and it started real quick. And there's something special about, you know, that first evening of being in the rafters at the Bell Center, looking down the ice and thinking, oh man, there's part of it I've made it, because I remember at the start of Student Works, there's a session that we have. A training session, and one of the things you guys make us do is write a dream that we have, or, you know, or a goal later on. And I believe I wrote work or play for the Montreal Canadiens. So evidently playing was still out of the question. So working was one of them. So yeah, so no, joined the team, and I got what I was doing is media planning and advertising at first. Mm-hmm. Then got into a bit more of the innovation side. So anything that touched esports. Anything new that was more digital was kind of my strong suit. So no, I just got in there, and timing was good. Worked hard for that year and a half, and they kept me on, and ended up being a six year ride. It was
four promotions. You know, so looking back, what were the big takeaways from working with the Canadiens?
Well, first of all, I think there's one thing of, no matter the size of the company, you'll be working with, you know, a smaller team within your department, and those people are your allies in what you're doing. So, you know, just get together and, you know, make stuff happen. It was impressive how many, you know, projects were done from that small team. And one thing that I've learned is, no matter the size of the brand, just bring it back to the basics. Yeah, it's not because you're coming in with the logo of the Canadiens are not better than someone. So I always trusted the salespeople I was talking to, the media people I was talking to, and they're the best at what they do. So, you know, I was a representative of a great brand, but if I listened to them, they'd make me look smart. So I think that's one big thing that came out, is I'd go into these meetings and say, hey, you're the professional here. You know, this is your media. What should I be doing? And the knowledge that would come out of those meetings, I'd come back, and during the presentation, I'd have the details that the person gave me. So that was one big part. And also just be a great team player. Go into people's offices and ask questions. If there's something, you know, I've always been super curious. And during that time was a great time to be it, you know, and go in these other areas of the business and learn from those people and get to understand every nook and cranny, because that's what makes you get these promotions and evolve in the business, and they can see you taking on new roles. I think another side is probably understand what you're good at and what you're not as good at. I think one thing that I had found out early on was in terms of you know, the HR side, I'm a great, I'm a pretty good leader, team player, but I might not be the guy that can fire someone else. That side is not, it's not within me. I'll always need someone beside me to do that. So I learned that, you know, for fairly early on. And so when I was taking the team, try to be, you know, more of a team player than that boss. Yeah.
Hey, leaders, I hope you are enjoying this podcast. As we approach and surpass 300 episodes, well over 95% of the leaders that we have interviewed have been alumni of the StudentWorks Management Program. It has been an honor to participate in their development over the years. Starting now, and only for the fall months, we will be on campus at universities and colleges in Ontario, Quebec, and the East Coast, interviewing students who think they have what it takes to start their first business and get started down the path of entrepreneurship. If you are interested in being a leader in our program or know someone who does, please go to the show notes and hit StudentWorks and get sent to a landing page to apply. There is a bold StudentWorks that you can hit to go to a landing page to apply. Thanks so much. Back to the show. No, I think that's great. And so it's, so, you know, and build on your strengths. You know, obviously one of the big things, you're very charismatic, you're very people focused, you're a great communicator. And that's kind of the theme or the string to me that draws you through to this next opportunity. So what had you thinking that about looking for a new opportunity, you know, that sort of thing with the Canadians and looking for the really amazing opportunity you're working at now?
Yeah. So part of it, there was big life changes. So I was now with a father of two very young kids. That will change perspective on everything in your life. And I'm just warning the young ones out there, you know, it gives you a whole different view. There's something about having 41 games per year that's not as great once you get the two kids the kids around, right? You know, amazing at first, but then you know later on they wake up at the same hour every morning, whether you had a game night or not. So maybe that was part of it. But I think what it was is also this happened just during the pandemic. So and evidently, I mean, the job had changed completely. We were remote working. We were working on great digital programs. So luckily enough, I was kept on the team. You know, a lot of these businesses and sports teams had to cut off a lot of people. So I got to enjoy that of, you know, living the esports era, you know, get to organize those tournaments and all that digitally. But we essentially went and lived outside of Montreal, went to the cottage of my parents-in-law. And while we were over there with the kids, kind of, you know, rediscovered what it was to live on the countryside. And that's where, you know, I'm from, a small town on the Eastern Township. So that had been my growing up. So some stuff was bringing me back towards home. And my wife's uncle, and this is something about I find about business owners, is they're always very modest about the size of some of their companies. So every New Year's, you know, I'd kind of sit down with him and he'd talk about his, I got this small plastic recycling shop and, you know, starting it up in Waterloo. And so because we were at 4 days per week, on a Friday, I decided to go play golf in Waterloo. And I said, hey, I'll come by. And, you know, evidently walk into this place. It's 100,000 square feet, two extrusion machines, a third one being built. And I know nothing about plastics at this moment. So all I see is just the sheer amount, I mean, monster that this place is. And what's your definition of small business, Pierre? There's something I don't get. So I got to meet their salesperson there. You know, the man was about 67, 68 years old at that time. And he was thinking about retirement, but didn't really want to take it fully and wanted to train someone. So that's where this spark kind of happened. The maybe kind of happened at that point. Like, hey, this, you know, why not? Maybe this is the next challenge where, you know, I think you guys had said it best, you know, you're either learning or you're earning in life. And I think that I needed to rejolt that side of learning. And this was the ultimate one because chemistry had never been my strong suit in school. I was always the marketing guy. And now I needed to learn about, you know, recycled plastics. So I think the talks went on. We found a home here in the townships, and stuff had, life has a way of aligning things in a way that everything just worked out. Kind of told the team, you know, again, leaving was something. I still have moments where, you know, I'll go see a hockey game and it still gets me. I can't not look at an ad or a sponsor or something like that and critic it, right? But yeah, I decided to jump all in. We made the move down here in the townships and been here for just over 3 years now.
No, fantastic. And so what's your role, or what is it grown to be, and how did that transition happen?
Yeah, so a lot of it at first, the initial deal was I was supposed to be on the side learning from the team, right? So there's a lot of these experts that are the chemistry people, the lab technicians and all that. And I just kind of, you know, learned, but I'd done it before with printers. I knew nothing about that technology and I'd learned it, you know, painting, same thing. You know, we took a bunch of courses and then boom, you're doing it the next summer. So it was in my, I think it was in my DNA to do this. Unfortunately, I think, so three months after I joined, the sales manager, which I was supposed to be slowly replacing, I went in for an operation and passed away. So woke up one morning and that was it. I was the new buyer and seller for the entire company. But again, you know, great team, great people. The man himself had great relationships with everybody. So again, you know, kind of called onto a lot of the customers and said, "Hey, this is what's happening. I know literally nothing, but I'll be the liaison. You know, I've got a great team behind me. I trust them and what they do. I might have to ask you questions about what you're talking about, but let's build this through." I'm looking back at it now and it seems surreal, but it worked out really well. We've been growing steadily ever since. And I brought in the side of, you know, again, my whole marketing side and working with big brands. I can cold call anybody now. You know, once you've talked to Gary Bettman, I think cold calling anybody is pretty easy. So that's been the transition. So about a year after I joined, we bought another recycling company here in Council, Energie Place. So essentially, for people that don't know, we're essentially what happens after your blue bin. So all the plastic you're putting into the blue bin comes in a bale format in Energie Place and Council, gets grinded, washed, sorted, and then brought back to Waterloo, where we make a final pellet. And that pellet is used in products that a lot of people know. One big Brunnberg segment of our customers is construction material and drainage pipe. So the big drainage pipes that you'll see in construction zones, those are often made of recycled materials that come from our pilot. So we've grown it to be, so we're producing 4.5 million pounds of recycled plastic per month. So not only great in terms of sales and all that, but also great for the environment, because this is technically, if we wouldn't be doing it, this could be landfilled or worse than that, you know, ocean and all that. So
100%. Yeah, no, and it's interesting. I'm a podcast listener as well as a podcast, you know, developer. You know, obviously we've stayed in touch over the years, but, you know, I was listening to you on a podcast about, you know, hey, the breakthroughs in plastics. And obviously, you know, I think, you know, most people are environmentalists, obviously. Hey, we're living here. We want the best thing possible for our world. We want the best thing possible as you and me for our kids and our grandchildren, because that's how we think. So, you know, why don't you share just some of the things, you know, for our listeners, how can we be better stewards? You know, obviously your company is a steward, you know, for us, but what sort of things can we do? How should we be thinking about plastics recycling?
Yeah. So, I mean, one big thing is, you know, what you're putting into your bin. I think in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of what we call wish cycling. So what people will do is that, you know, they'll take any object, they'll kind of look at it and they'll say, "Boss, someone's going to sort this later," and just throw it into the bin. I now see what kind of havoc that can cause. I've seen, you know, all kinds of weird things that come into the bin. And I think one of the big things is, well, first of all, locally, everything changes locally. So I don't know where all your listeners are from. So the best thing is always to kind of look at the program that comes into your, a lot of cities will give you a program of what goes into your bin locally in terms of acceptance. But the main trick is always two different questions you have to ask yourself. Is it a container, packaging, or printed materials? And if the answer is yes to that, then you go into the second question of, is it metal, glass, plastic, paper, or cardboard? And if it's yes to those two, that definitely goes into your bin. And if it's not, then it might go to your local eco center. There's a lot of stuff that can be reused. A lot of stuff that can also be recycled. It just needs another step of treatment, not to go and clog up the sorting centers. I visited a couple of sorting centers and I can see what people, one great example is a full hose, 100-foot hose. Well, these grinders are these big tumblers and they just turn. So imagine 100-foot hose just getting stuck into it. So you'll see batteries are a big, you have to be careful about that. That can cause a fire inside the sorting center.
Yes. Wow.
So it's more about the stuff to avoid and being conscious of thinking about it, as you're going to throw it away is, can I do this? And doing a bit more research. There's a lot of apps now that are out. I know locally here, Recyc Quebec came out with an app. I'm pretty sure the rest of Canada with Circular Materials also has it out. So it kind of tells you what locally can be recycled and what it becomes. But if you put it in the bin, we'll recycle it.
Well, and what's neat as well is it's great, hearing from your perspective at a very, very high level. And I remember, obviously I do lots of interview. And I remember talking to one of our operators who did very, very well in the Gravenhurst area, but he actually was sorting out material and he talked about what that looked like and how to, so it's all of a sudden you're thinking a lot more, clearly. And I know for me, I'm in charge of our family recycling. So I take it very seriously. And I've got some more information to get Jonathan so I can do a better job. So that's awesome.
It's a lot. I mean, even before I joined this company, there's a lot of stuff that I was doing that I had no idea that you shouldn't be putting into the bin. It's been a weird, we forget that not so long ago, you had to sort all your materials, put them in little bins. And you had to put those bins on the side of the street. And that lasted for a certain time. And then they said, no, let's just throw it all into one bin. And then some companies are bigger and better and they're on Facebook and they're saying, oh, put your glass. Well, yes, locally, but maybe not where you're at. Depends on the centers. But I think what's encouraging now is that with Eco-Entreprise here in Quebec and Circular Materials out in Canada, what they're trying to do is unifying the systems. So they want essentially the same message to be across so there's less confusion. Because I can understand the consumer there's so much information being thrown at them that, is this recycle? Is it not? And especially that one big change that needs to happen is that the little symbols that we're used to seeing that seems to say recycling, essentially it's only an identification of what plastic it is or what material it is. It's not saying it is recyclable where you're at. It could be. And that's a great thing, but I think they need to be more precise on that and not assume that all the consumers know exactly what they're doing with their recycling. Yeah.
Like everything, education for
yep.
sure.
Yeah. 100%.
So right now, your role in this big company is really you're in many ways the face of the company. You're in charge of sales and communicating with all these customers. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. And one big part in what we do is also the purchasing side. So we have to bring in the raw materials. So I think that's been a lot of the learning over the last couple of years is buying the right type of plastic, learning the right descriptions that I have to give the salespeople of what we need and what we need it for. A lot of it is a big part is buying, selling, depending on what time of the year the sales, I don't want to say they come naturally, but if we produce them, we produce it well, a lot of the customers that we have are ready to increase their volumes, especially now as we're kind of good timing in terms of legislation. There's a lot of recycled content mandates coming up California started up, and whenever California starts something, it kind of trickles through the states. So what we need to do is really, develop the right recipes to create this recycled product that people can use, replace the virgin plastic with, and make sure that they know that we're ready for it, and just continuously grow our inputs of great material that we can use. A lot of it's going to come from people recycling better, industries recycling better too, because a lot of recycling comes from what we call post-consumer. So that's your blue bin. But there's a lot of post-industrial also. So think of Clean Farms as a good example. Farmers will bring all their jugs and their drums and all that to the side of the street. And there's a collection process that's done. That material is washed and brought back in. So that's potentially some post-industrial material. There's also plastic companies out there making great products, but they also, you know, they'll have their rejects, they'll have, you know, their bad products. So we'll take that and we'll grind it up, find out the specifications and reuse it within our product. So partnering up with companies like that, that want to have the circular economy kind of built into their model. So yeah, so a lot of it is purchasing. And then the reason why I'm super active on LinkedIn and online is just making people aware of what's going on. I know that some people are working at these huge companies that they might not even know that they're having an impact. And if they take 2 minutes to look at their warehouse or look at the production process, they might notice that a bin of plastic is being thrown out. Well, I can value that and give you some value for it, bring it into our plant, turn it into something new. And there's a great marketing story to that. And I'm working closely with the people in drainage right now, where it's essentially been mathematically proven that a drainage pipe would last over 100 years. So I mean, the story tells itself right there. You take a piece of plastic, throw it away, it gets recycled, but then it goes into a 100-year product. That's a lot better than the landfill. So there's a big, that's why they know the me being so active on online and all that, try to get these questions. And I'm getting, I think what's fun is that recently we've been signing a lot of NDAs of companies that want to get ready for what's coming up. They've been using virgin plastic and that's still what they're using now, but they want to start testing so that they're ready when this does come around in 1 or 2 years. Because when it comes to chemistry, I'm seeing it live. You can't just snap your fingers and all of a sudden tell people like, here's the same product but with recycled content. You might not be able to get the color that the marketing people want. I've mentioned this in the past, but the HAPs, they're very, very precise on their red, their white, and their blue. It's super specific. Unfortunately, I can't produce that red. There's no way I can sort my way through plastic to create that red. So that's a big change that some companies might have to take and say, hey, we're committed to recycled materials, but it might involve a bit of a change in our marketing side too.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. No. And again, it's kind of just, a company is, I think that's a great example, doing something away and then all of a sudden, discovering, look, here's actually a way to make extra money and a way to redeploy assets. So I get to be both things, environmentally conscious, make extra money for this extra step. So it's just an awareness that we need to, as a nation, as a world, become more and more aware of. So, yep. As these things change. So I know we've been talking about a lot of things that have been working, but we know, and one question we always talk about is mistakes or failures. So anything sort of that stands out, any lessons that you've learned from them?
If I go back to the student works days, one thing was underestimating myself and not hiring enough people. Building a great team around you, and build a bigger team and just sell more so that that team can work. I think that's one thing that I remember making as a mistake. And if not, what can come to mind? Doubting yourself in sales. Pick up that phone and do the calls. And depending on what industry you're in, there's an average time for a sales cycle. Learn what that is and roll with it. Because 3 months from now, if you haven't made calls today, 3 months from now, you're going to regret it. That's where a lot of the business comes back, and you get to learn these sales cycles. Sometimes you don't trust the process, but a lot of these sales companies, they have systems in place and they tell you about it and you kind of don't listen to it, but definitely do listen to it. I think I didn't, at Ricoh, I didn't trust myself enough at first. And, it wasn't going as good as I thought. And then all of a sudden it started kicking in, but it's only because that was the normal sales cycle for it. So if I doubled down back then, I'd be, I'd have made President's Club again and that'd have been it. So, if there's a process in place, grab the system and trust it for sure.
No, I think that's actually a huge thing that we see is the people who just, again, follow what's been tried and true. For us, it's like 40 plus years, this is, and we just keep improving it. So Ricoh would be even longer, or whatever organization that you're joining, and they're not teaching something to have you, we kind of think this is going to work. No, they're investing a whole lot of money in you. and time, exactly. And energy and training and with customers. So it's follow that process and and put the blinders on is a huge, huge best practice for sure.
And then once it starts coming in, then the motivation comes from itself, right? Then you start seeing results. But that first, you know, probationary period, I'd say in every job where you think it's not working, but all those seeds you're planting, at some point you'll get a phone call back. And sometimes it's the person you least expect. It's going to give you a call back, and that's it. You just started to roll. So yeah, man, I'm seeing it now. There's a lot of, I'm in an industry now that works a lot by conferences. So we'll go out to these conferences. You'll meet a bunch of people, you know, have quick chats about all kinds of things. And, you know, you walk away, sometimes you'll forget about some of those conversations. And, you know, 3 months later, you get a phone call like, hey, you remember we spoke about, how about I order a couple of rail cars? And wait, what?
Yeah, exactly.
That's a good example. Yeah.
And so what did you need to change about yourself, John, to become a value creator?
Yeah, I think a big part of it was putting the system in place. That's my biggest thing. I can be out there and outgoing and do presentations and all that, but to put the system in place of, you know, following up, closing. I think closing was a big one. I was a great conversation starter, and the closing part and asking for the sale was not something I was good at. So the moment that started coming back in. Still not the best at it. I'm still a great conversation starter, sustainable, you know, keep that customer relationship. But that last closing part is one that I'd have to bring in and kind of develop. And you know, the more practice you put to it, at some point again, it becomes a natural part, and you start doing it, you realize how much you got better at it. But that was one thing that I definitely needed to change, because I was having these great conversations with people about their house, and then, well, I got to paint it now, so you know, maybe sign that contract.
Yeah, and again, it's like there's a strength that all of us have, and then we also need to work on our weaknesses or those things that make us uncomfortable and step into them. So, and what key habits would someone want to steal from you, John?
I think one big one, and I don't know if it's a habit, but I'm always trying to be curious. If there's something I don't know during my day, turn around and Google it. I've learned so many things where, I mean, I think the Habs was one of my realizations, where it was nothing I'd learned in school, nothing I'd done in the past. It's all stuff that I just took the time to dig in and find out what it actually was. You know, how does the Google algorithm work? You know, I learned it myself. It's not, you know, there's no course on that at Concordia, unfortunately. You just learn as you go. So I always try to be very, very curious in what I do. And same thing again now, you know, if there's a part I don't know about the plastic, the specifications, I go back and I ask questions, and I'll cold call the guy and ask them to tell me more about it, just because I'm not sure I understand it. One thing that I've added in also on my side that I think is key for a lot of people now is the mental health side. Didn't realize how hard it can be to be in sales or in sports and entertainment, and these high-paced, high-action industries, it gets a toll on you. And there's moments where you need to take a pause and, you know, either consult with someone or you know, ask some questions and see where you stand on the mental health side. And not be shy about it. I think it's less and less of a taboo, but there still is a bit of a, you know. And once you start talking about it, you realize that, you know, you'll talk to your friends, and everybody has seen a psychologist in the last couple of years. You know, therefore, whether it's being about, in my case, it was about, you know, the challenge of becoming a new father, still being super performing at work, and, you know, the pandemic and all that. So that was kind of my kickoff point. But that's something that I'm a lot more aware of now. And, you know, kind of attached to that, I guess, to force myself into staying active and sports and all that. I got myself in a basketball league with a bunch of boys, and, you know, every Monday they keep me true to it. You know, they'll text you and it's like, you better show up tonight. It's not as easy as it used to be with the kids and all that. But that's the moment that I've got once a week where we go out and play some ball for a couple of hours. It hurts the next morning, but it keeps you active and gets the habit started. And if, you know, ideally there's more than that, but at least there's that one that I'm committed to. And I think it's a habit that I've taken now to keep it on my schedule and make sure that's there.
Yeah. There's a great podcast, Netflix show called Stutz, S-T-U-T-Z. He's a very, very popular therapist, Jonah Hill's therapist. And he really does a great job of talking about the power of therapy. And Jonah Hill sort of jokes, he's a comedian, obviously, that, hey, your friends will give you all sorts of advice and therapists don't. Well, and Stutz does. And one of the big things that he talks about is that, you know, therapy is, he looks at life like a pyramid. And on the bottom of the pyramid are all sorts of things that are, quote unquote, mental health and deal with our mental health. But we actually can deal with it. Our physical activity, our diet, you know, some basic things that are just so, so critical to feeling good, more likely to be feeling better than otherwise because we're doing these things. And then the final top of the pyramid are the things that we are helpful to go talk to a therapist about. And for me, I've been, you know, at different types of therapists over the years and very, very helpful to understand me, understand my family dynamics, understand, you know, the things I chose to do as a child. And so, but the things that largely have me feeling good every day are actually physically being active. What am I eating? Am I sleeping well? The, you know, a bunch of basic things. And Jonah Hill talks about, like, as a young person, he was 140 pounds overweight. I think that's the number he talked about. And he's just saying he didn't understand that that actually was impacting his mental health. You know, he just thought, oh, just people wanted him to lose weight and they were fat shaming. You know, no. It's about physical and your mental health.
Yeah. I know. And there's something about being on the, you know, being about on the court and, you know, the feeling that competition too. I mean, we're not, again, not at the same level we were back in high school, but there's still some competition. You're still blowing off some steam and there's stuff from your day, you know, that didn't go as well. And that just comes out on the game and you leave it on the court. You know, it's a cool way to pass it through. And like you said, the, you know, getting a good therapist. I was probably the first one that was very doubtful of it. And what I didn't want is I didn't want a motherly therapist. I didn't want someone else to tell me like you're working too much. Like I am a bit of a workaholic. I find a lot of pleasure in working. So I wanted to find someone that understood that. So landed on a person that was very good with C-level executives again. Was from big companies, and she said, okay, this is normal, and here's. And yeah, they help you identify things that, again, from your past or ways that you'll feel joy. And one of the things that I remember that came out of on my side, and I found it fun, was that I'd get because of the way my mother was very open about me helping others. Well, I get great pride and I feel joy by helping someone else. So that's why I was always better at somehow. I can't do my own homework, but if someone asks me to help for his homework, I'll do that first, you know? So things like that, that's a good example. Yeah. And I definitely, suggest, as these leaders are growing up, definitely, you know, do that, you know, so reach out and take the time to do it. And you can find out some stuff about yourself that you didn't know was there.
100%. And so final question, when you think of a leader of tomorrow, John, what do you think of?
Yeah, well, I think that they kind of speak to where I'm at. I think there needs to be for the future now a sustainability aspect to leadership. Think about your business in a long-term way, you know, not just a fast win, but what's the long-term gain and then the environment around you. And the other side, I guess the HR side, be a people leader by example, that go out there and do the work and show people that the work can be done by doing it. I think that, you know, leaders of tomorrow are going to have to lead a generation that's much different than even, you know, mine or yours, where working is not the same as it was. So inspire these people to follow your, you know, embark with you on this mission that you have of your business. I think that'll be a key for leaders of tomorrow.
So that's fantastic. So thanks so much for joining us today, John.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Hey leaders, I hope you enjoyed this episode. By now, you are aware that we work with ambitious students every single year to not only help them run their first successful business, but to further their development as a leader and give them an unfair advantage in the future over their counterparts. It's why starting now and only for the next few weeks, we'll be on campuses across Ontario, Quebec, and the East Coast, interviewing students who think they have what it takes to start their first business and get started down their path of entrepreneurship. If you think you have what it takes or know someone who might be interested, visit leaderspodcast.ca/apply and start your application process today. Once again, it's leaderspodcast.ca/apply, and I can't wait to see you on the other side.